person," Julia said. "It is my firm conviction that centuries from now, young Martians sitting in classrooms on the Red Planet will read in their history books, or whatever they have in place of books, about this meeting and what came of it." Ravi Kumar raised an index finger. "Instead of educating the young in classrooms," he said, "why not do away altogether with the traditional structure of mass education and take a personalized, individualized approach? There's no reason to repeat Earth's mistakes on Mars." "I could not agree with you more," Julia said, "and these sorts of fresh ideas only make me more eager to find a way of getting as many people there as soon as possible. How do we get started? What would be entailed in sending a forward advance party to Mars?" For the second time in as many minutes, Dr. Quine looked a bit unsettled. She glanced around Arclet 453. This was the central, common space arclet of the heptad that included numbers 174, the abode of Julia and Camilla, and 215, that of Spencer Grindstaff. Or at least, that was what it said on the official records. Some reshuffling had occurred. All the men and women who lived in those two arclets now seemed to conceive of themselves as members of JBF's personal staff. They had taken over 453 and turned it into a sort of West Wing. Catherine Quine said, "Presuming we had authorization to send such a mission, let me just cut you off there if you would indulge me, Dr. Quine. What you just raised is a matter of politics. I consider that to be my superpower, and I would like to place it at the disposal of you and the other members of the Martian community. The ones you already know of, the ones who sympathize with you in secret, and others who may sign on once it becomes clear to them what a fundamentally sensible idea the Mars trip really is. So I would propose that we assume, for purposes of this little chat, that authorization is not a problem. I would like to see you three using your own superpower of designing this mission in a way that makes sense, without letting the political dimension interfere at all. Once we have designed a coherent plan, we can then move on to questions of implementation."
"In a perfect scenario, we would dump the rock and simply take everything, all at once,"
Janyu said. It was the first time he had spoken, but he seemed to have been emboldened by Julia's talk of superpowers. "There are powerful forces that would have to be convinced before such a thing could happen," Julia said. "Let's think in terms of an advance party. Lean, efficient, smart, but big enough to get the job done. That means landing on Mars and reporting back to the remainder of the Cloud Arc."
"We've been talking about such a mission. We think we could do it with a bolo consisting of a heptad and a triad," Catherine said.
10 arclets," Julia said. "That doesn't seem all that many, does it?"
"During the initial Delta V," Ravi Kumar said, "the arclets would be stacked. Once they were on course for Mars, they would form a bolo, so that the members of the expedition could experience Earth normal gravity during the 6-month journey."
John Yu added, "Propulsion and other components could come from the MIV kit. Most of the design work has already been done for us." Catherine said,
"Aerobraking would be needed at the end to slow it down. Before that, the bolo could be reeled in, the arclets could restack into a unified ship, and there would be time to survey the surface from orbit and decide on a landing place."
Julia nodded. "And if I may put a hard question to you all, what would be the survival time of this isolated colony once it had landed? How long before it ran out of provisions?" This caused the three Martians to clam up and look at one another.
"I only ask," Julia said, "because politics, my department, once again rears its ugly head here. Once your heroics have been accomplished, the burden falls to me to seal the deal, as it were. The advance party lands and sends back its joyous message. A ticking clock element enters the picture, which I do not mean in a negative way. This can be a powerful incentive to mobilize people's energies, as we saw in the case of the build-up to the hard rain. It is at that point when I can address the people of the Cloud Arc and say, Here is the opportunity. Will we seize it? Or will we shrink away from it and let these brave people slowly expire? That is a speech that I think I could deliver to great effect. I just need to have some sense of the time element.
A year for sure, Catherine said. Beyond that, it becomes a medical question. A statistical question.
Statistics, Julia repeated and sighed. I have been hearing a lot about that from Dr. Harris. So you're telling me we've lost track of who is even in JBF's heptad?
Ivy asked. There was silence around the big table in the banana. Ivy had begun to hold important meetings in this old familiar space, closer to the central axis of the stack, and farther forward in Amalthea's cone of shelter. It wouldn't do to have the Cloud Ark's command structure decapitated by a single unlucky bolide strike, a disaster much more likely to happen whenever they met in the big T3 spaces like the tank and the farm. Present for this meeting were Dub, Louisa, Fyodor, and three hand-picked members of Marcus's staff who had become a sort of executive troika. Sal Guodian, the one-man judicial system, Tekla, the head of security, and Steve Lake, the dreadlocked ginger who was responsible for network and computer matters.
The default system for keeping track of who is where, Sal began, is based on the assumption that people will actually cooperate with it.
Ivy held up a hand. Stop. Before you go into explanations, I need a yes or no.
Yes, Steve Lake said. We have lost track of who is in JBF's heptad.
Thank you, Ivy said. And somehow the sun isn't helping us fill in the gaps?
Steve said, One of the people who is definitely in that heptad is Spencer Grindstaff.
Ivy nodded.
Sal said, Steve, when Marcus pulled you into his office just before the white sky and put you in charge of the network, replacing Spencer, you made some remark to the effect that Spencer might know of back doors into Izzy's systems. Back doors that would be impossible for you to know about until he used them.
Yeah, Steve said. Almost by definition, we can't find something like that until it's used. Not without manually reading through every line of code.
You think he has a back door into the SAN?
We know he's doing something, Steve said. Because as soon as he turned up there, the arklets in JBF's heptad began dropping off the network from time to time. Whenever she's having a meeting she doesn't want us to know about, he turns everything off.
Ivy considered this for a moment, then looked across the table at Tekla and nodded. Tekla rose, carefully, for the gravity was quite weak here, and went to the door. She opened it to reveal Zeke Peterson waiting outside and waved him in.
Thanks for joining us,
Ivy said, breaking a silence during which Zeke took a seat at the foot of the table. Ivy was at the head of it. She was looking up a long ski jump ramp at him, and he was doing likewise at her.
Just like old times, Commander Shao,
Zeke said.
Well, I appreciate your loyalty, Ivy said. I know this must be awkward for you.
Not at all, actually,
Zeke said.
The announcement that Marcus made, when he called it, at the onset of the hard rain, declaring all existing nations to be dissolved, I took that to heart. Julia didn't hear that announcement. She didn't get the memo.
We've been hearing a little about Spencer's ability to disconnect from San.
Zeke nodded.
Confirmed. I was there for one such incident. We had a very strange conversation. I think they were testing the waters to see whether I might be recruited. She spoke to me as if I were already on her side, as if it were unthinkable that I wouldn't be. It's a pretty good persuasive technique. She had me going for a little bit. But once I got out of there and slept on it, I saw how crazy it was.
Did you have the sense that this was a one-off, or was she working her way down a list of possible recruits?
If I had to guess, I'd say there was a list,
Zeke said.
But not a long list.
Ivy nodded. She didn't have to spell it out. JBF might have recruited some others,
others they didn't know about yet.
It tallies with what I saw,
Dube said, and glanced at Louisa for a confirming nod.
I think she is just being opportunistic. She reaches out to people, draws them into conversations, drops hints, probes for vulnerabilities.
Is she nuts? Ivy asked Louisa. In a sense, it doesn't matter, Louisa said. If she's making trouble, she's making trouble. Tracing it to a diagnosable psychiatric condition doesn't really change anything.
It might change the approach that we take.
She was narcissistic to begin with, Louisa said. This isn't a formal diagnosis, mind you. But according to what we heard from you and Dinah, her trip up to Izzy was pretty traumatic. She lost her husband and her child, and blood was spilled along the way. It doesn't take a trained professional to guess that she is suffering from some level of PTSD. Connected with that, we might expect her to have a dark, paranoid vision of the world. But she may have been that way to begin with.
She's cagey, Ivy said. As long as all she's doing is talking to people, there's not much I can or should do.
Agreed, Louisa said. She is building a political base among the Arkies. If you take some action against her, with your sole pretext being that she's talking to a lot of people, then you've given her just what she wants. But some outreach on your part to the Arkies might be a good idea.
Ivy sighed. The only answer to politics is more politics, she said, and that's where I'm most useless.
Deeds, not words,
Zeke said.
That's what really matters. And when Emir pulls in, you and Marcus will have accomplished something that's going to make JBF and her clique look puny.
I may be out of my depth here, Julia said after a long and thoughtful pause. But we seem to have a striking coincidence that is staring us right in the face.
Go on, Madam President, Camilla urged her. It might be obvious to you, but I for one cannot see it.
Julia looked at Catherine Quine. As I understand it, the key elements of the proposed Mars ship are Heptad, for the humans to live in during the voyage, and a Triad, for bulk storage of propellants and whatnot. And this matches up quite neatly with our strengths. She managed a self-deprecating chuckle. I say our. What do I mean by that? I suppose I am going out on a limb by imagining that there might be some sort of a natural alliance between the Arki community and the Martians, a sort of ragtag rebel coalition, if you will. Here in this Heptad, we have rapidly assembled a social hub for advocacy of concerns relevant to the AC. In a sense, we have our own Heptad now. And in a like sense, you, Ravi, and Janyu have developed your triad into an intense focus of Martian advocacy. You have your own triad. So the two largest components of the Mars expedition have already been acquired. They just need to be put together. Ravi was nodding.
Two of the engineers on the MIV team are keen on it. They hope to build new Caird and are eager to tackle a new problem. Of the two, one might even come with us. Paul Friel. He has been a strong advocate of Mars colonization since long before Zero.
Catherine had been listening intently and now broke in. I don't mean to sound a skeptical note, Madam President. But in what sense do you really have this Heptad? Or do our friends here have the Triad where they live? It might be true in the sense of having majority rule, but what does ownership really mean in this context? Yes, it is a very profound question, Dr. Quine, and I'm glad you raised it. So many things we took for granted before, such as property rights and individual liberty, are clouded by Marcus's declaration of PSAPs, or martial law, if we want to call a spade a spade. But as a first step toward answering your question, I would suggest that the ability to come and go at will is inextricable from ownership. That's what it would really mean to have an Arklet, or a Triad, or a Heptad.
Well, in that sense,
We're really all subject to the collective dictates of the swarm, Catherine said. Perambulator is what decides where we go when.
It truly is one of the most insidious instruments of social control ever devised, Julia said.
Catherine looked mildly aghast. But without it, we have a disaster.
That is what makes it so insidious, Julia said. One can always justify it by making the safety argument. We will all be slaves of Perambulator until and unless someone decides that some things are more important.
Jian Yu was looking alert and curious. If someone did decide that, he said, it would change nothing unless the arclet in question was switched over to manual control.
It's my understanding that this can be done at any time, Julia said. Was I misinformed?
No, Jian Yu answered, but it would show up very prominently on Perambulator. It would set off alarms all over the situational awareness network.
In that case, Julia said, we shall have to deal with the San when and if the time comes to take decisive action.
Ivy's grandmother, a Guangzhou-born, Hong Kong-raised woman who spoke only a few words of English, had ruled the family from a mother-in-law apartment over a garage in Reseda. Enthroned on a duct-taped lazy boy and swaddled in crocheted afghans, she had handed down a series of diktats, pronunciamentos, and fatwas that had taken on the force of law within her family of 36 direct descendants and in-laws scattered across the San Fernando Valley. While not indifferent to money, love, security, and other common psychological drives, she seemed to have been motivated by another need that was obscure, and hence mysterious, to most of those who paid fealty to her. Anglos might have orientalized this as face, or Confucian respect for one's elders. Ivy came to understand it as a simple need for attention. Anyone who entered or left the house had to check in with grandmother. And it was not enough just to poke one's head in the door and say hello or goodbye. One had to sit down in the rattan side chair next to the lazy boy and spend a few minutes and say a few words. Grandmother had no power to enforce this regulation other than finding arcane and baroque ways to wreak long-term revenge on those who flouted it. Julia Bliss Flaherty, as Ivy now realized, was of the same stripe. Pinned down and obliged to justify herself, she would explain her actions in terms of some altruistic plan, and she might even believe it. But it wasn't that at all. She was like Ivy's grandmother. If you paid fealty to her, she would favor you, and your reputation and power would grow among all the others who did likewise. If you sent her off to an arclet and ignored her, you became an enemy of her and of her network. She wielded no power other than that. But ignored long enough, she could become a mighty foe. Her status as an ex-president, and not just any old ex-president, but the one who had overseen the construction of the Cloud Ark and even used nuclear weapons to protect it, gave her credibility among the Arkies. It had become common to think of those as scattered and demoralized, just waiting for a leader to bring them identity and purpose. Ivy had lost track of whether that was an accurate perception or a self-perpetuating myth spread by JBF. In any case, it had taken on the force of reality. She was sitting across the table from Tekla, wondering whether it would be productive to explain all of these thoughts to her. Would this Russian heptathlete care about or understand Ivy's dead Cantonese grandmother in Reseda? Maybe. But Tekla came from a tradition in which details were hoarded and dispensed on a need-to-know basis. Presented with too much information, she became baffled, bored, and finally irritated. Toward those who talked too freely, she felt the same sort of contempt as a businessman might feel toward a spendthrift. She just wanted to know what her job was. The same quality made it difficult to get inside Tekla's head. But that was okay. In a big organization with a military-style chain of command, you didn't have to be everyone's friend and treasured colleague. Marcus understood as much, which was why he had ended up running the place. More Ivy Speed had been the boutique operation that had been Izzy at Zero. Marcus would have been terrible at that.
"This thing with Julia is a distraction. Nothing more," Ivy said. "Much more important things demand my focus. Making a big deal out of it will backfire, give her more power than she deserves. But we can't ignore what she is doing."
Tekla was nodding. "Good.
I want you to go and visit her heptad," Ivy continued. "You will go there in your capacity as Marcus's security chief. Do you understand? It is an official visit. You will explain that there have been problems with the situational awareness network that could have dangerous consequences unless they are fixed. Beyond that, I just want you to listen to her. Because I think that she will try to bring you over to her side. It's what she does with everyone. You would be a prize catch."
"If she does as you predict," Tekla said, "what should be my response?"
It was a measure of Ivy's naivete that she didn't even follow Tekla's question at first. Then she understood that Tekla was suggesting she might pretend to become one of Julia's followers. She was volunteering to become a mole in Julia's network. Tekla stolidly watched Ivy's face as Ivy figured it out.
"I would suggest taking no immediate action," Ivy said, which in truth was Ivy being not so much cagey as timid.
"Of course," Tekla said. "To show eagerness is poor tactics. It will only arouse her suspicion."
Ivy said nothing.
Tekla explained, "I know many people with such minds."
"And you obviously don't, honey." "My suggestion is that you report to me in person first, and then we will come to a decision."
"We?"
"I. I will come to a decision."
"It is good that we meet here, in the banana,"
Tekla said. "You like it?"
Tekla looked nonplussed.
"It is not that I like it. The banana is more secure."
"From bolides, you mean?"
Tekla shook her head.
"From grindstuff."
Then she stood up, carefully, so as not to fly up and bang her head on the ceiling, and departed, leaving Ivy alone with a head full of questions. Had she really just embarked on the project of setting up an internal espionage network within the Cloud Ark? How was she going to explain that to Marcus? Would he be horrified or impressed? In either case, how would she feel about his reaction? When the hell was Dinah going to get back so that they could discuss this kind of thing over distilled spirits? And what had Tekla meant by that last comment, that the banana was more secure from grindstaff? It was old, pre-Zero, and so its connection to the San was retrofitted and kludgy. Tekla seemed to be suggesting that if Spencer could hack the San to the extent of disconnecting Julia's arclets from it, then maybe he could also hack it to the extent of placing other parts of the Cloud Ark, including the farm, the tank, and Marcus's office, under surveillance.
"I know many people with such minds,"
Tekla had said. She was talking about Russian military and intelligence types, accustomed to the Byzantine thoughtways of those professions. Perhaps Tekla herself had once been groomed as an intelligence asset. If Tekla really did become a mole in Julia's network, then how could Ivy be sure that she was a straight-up mole, loyal to Ivy, and not a double agent, loyal to Julia? The scrape with the atmosphere had left Ymir tumbling slowly as it hurtled away from the Earth on its new orbit. Calculating exactly what that orbit was took them 15 or 20 minutes, and told them that they had fewer than 4 hours in which to take actions needed to save their lives. If all had gone perfectly, the nuclear burn would have slowed Ymir down to the point where a rendezvous with Izzy could then have been achieved with a few small additional Delta Vs. They had hoped this might happen, but not seriously expected it. The best they could really hope for was to shed some velocity and reduce the height of their apogee. That figure, the distance separating the Earth and the ship at the top of her orbit, was directly related to how much velocity she had at the bottom. Because Ymir had fallen in from an extremely high apogee, far beyond the moon's former orbit, she'd come in screaming hot for her skip off the atmosphere. Every bit of velocity that was killed by the huge nuclear retro-rocket burn, or by friction with the air, translated into a lower altitude at the succeeding apogee, which, depending on how the numbers had worked out, would occur weeks, days, or hours later. The answer, once they had run the numbers, turned out to be hours. In one sense, Ymir had missed her target by a mile. The total delta V she had achieved had been less than a third of what they'd hoped for. And yet, this had been enough to bring her apogee down from far beyond the moon's orbit to a figure only about thrice the altitude at which Izzy circled the Earth. Likewise, the period, the amount of time it took to complete an orbit, had dropped from 75 days to a mere 8 hours. The lesson being that huge alterations in those figures could be purchased for comparatively small amounts of delta V. Bringing Ymir the rest of the way down to Izzy's orbit, on the other hand, would require twice as much delta V as they'd run out of the burn just completed. Long before worrying about that, however, they would have to survive the next 8 hours. Ymir's apogee might have been radically altered, but her perigee altitude was unchanged, meaning that it was still dangerously low. If they took no action, the next go-round would therefore bring them roaring and bouncing across the top of the atmosphere again. On one level, raising the perigee a bit, so that they'd never have to worry about the atmosphere again, was an easy task. They could do it with a small but precisely calibrated burn at apogee. In a normal space mission, such a thing would have been straightforward. Here it was complicated by two factors. First of all, their success in lowering the apogee, and shortening the period, had imposed a tight deadline, 4 hours after perigee, when that burn needed to occur. The second complication was the ship's slow tumble. This meant that their nuclear rocket engine was never pointed in the right direction, save by lucky accident. During the big burn at perigee, they had wanted the nozzle pointed forward, so that it could serve as a huge retro rocket. The upcoming burn at apogee was intended to speed her up a bit, and so they needed the nozzle pointed aft. But as long as she tumbled, it was aimed in no particular direction. So their task now was to stabilize Ymir's attitude by using her thrusters to push back against the unwanted rotation. And, as they had discovered the first time they'd tried it, her thrusters were small and weak compared to the momentum of the big ice shard. In aerospace lingo, they lacked control authority. Ymir was like a truck skidding on a patch of oil, responding only faintly to the steering wheel. That problem had been alleviated somewhat by the large expenditure of mass during the burn. Many tons of ice had been hurled out the nozzle in the form of steam. Ymir was lighter and more wieldy as a result. Calculating exactly how much more wieldy she was and what it meant for the thruster's control authority was, in itself, a significant task that consumed another half an hour, just for a rough estimate. The result was not encouraging. In the 3 hours remaining, there was simply no way that Ymir's attitude control thrusters, designed for tiny adjustments over long spans of time, could neutralize her tumble. The tumble wasn't especially fast. The crew in the command module could barely sense that they were rotating. But it was enough to make the next rocket burn impossible. And if they couldn't make that burn in 3 hours, they'd scrape the atmosphere again in an additional 4, and again 8 hours after that. They might survive one more ride like the first one, but they couldn't survive 2. Once all of this had become clear to Marcus, he had divided the crew in half, leaving Dinah and Jiro in the command module's common room to look after the propulsion system, and going above with Vyacheslav to consider the problem of attitude control. Dinah's task was, comparatively speaking, routine. During the perigee burn, they had expended most of the ice stored in the hoppers. Some of the augers had jammed, and the whole ice mining operation had been thrown into general disarray as she had improvised solutions to problems that came at her from every direction. Robots were in the wrong places, some hoppers were overfull, while others were empty. New ice needed to be mined, and old ice needed to be rearranged. Fixing all of that in time for another burn in 3 hours was not an insuperable task, but it would require her full attention. Likewise, Jiro had a few reactor issues to think about. Both of them would have to toil diligently between now and the apogee burn in order to be ready. Assuming, that is, that the other half of the crew had, in the meantime, figured out a way to get Ymir aimed in the right direction. Marcus had moved that job to another part of the ship where it wouldn't pose a distraction to the propulsion crew. Or such was his intent. But in moments when Dinah lost focus briefly, while compiling some code or foraging for a snack, she found herself wondering what they were doing up there. By process of elimination, it had to be something involving New Caird. They'd already demonstrated that Ymir's thrusters weren't up to the task. Only New Caird's main engine had enough thrust to make a difference. The problem was that it was pointed in one fixed direction, which didn't happen to be the one in which they actually needed to push. Following that chain of reasoning to its logical conclusion made her nervous, to the point where she was almost more distracted than she would have been had Marcus and Slava been working in the same room with her. She held her curiosity and her trepidation at bay until she was certain that the engine would have enough ice to achieve the apogee burn. Her work was finished. Half an hour remained. Jiro seemed to have his side of it under control. A sharp thud, resounding through the walls of the command module, gave her an excuse to pull up some video and to eavesdrop on the audio channel that Marcus and Slava were using. Robots, salted all over Ymir's exterior, gave her eyes that she could turn in any direction. Even so, it took her a few minutes to obtain a picture of what was going on. New Caird had undocked from Ymir and was nowhere to be seen. Presumably, Marcus was at her controls. A man in a spacesuit was visible on the outside of Ymir, walking toward the stern by using a pair of grabs as mobile anchor points. This had to be Vyacheslav. His feet had sprouted thick white whiskers. It took Dinah a few moments to make sense of the image. He had zip-tied each foot to the back of a grab, and the whiskers were the protruding ends of the zip-ties. It was the kind of improvisation that would have made old-school NASA engineers turn over in their graves, had the hard rain not eliminated that possibility. But in the last 2 years, and particularly the last 2 weeks, this kind of hillbilly engineering had become routine, which only made the question of what the hell Marcus was up to more compelling. If Slava was being that creative with two robots and a sack of zip ties, she finally spotted New Caird on a camera belonging to a bucky that was attached to the stern of the shard, about halfway between its edge and the cavernous maw of the nozzle. The little ship was hanging in space, maybe 100 meters away, white jets erupting from her attitude thrusters every few moments as she tried to keep station behind the slowly rotating shard. Marcus was flying her by hand, and it was some fancy flying indeed. The geometry was difficult to visualize, but Dinah convinced herself that Vyacheslav was walking toward the same general location that New Caird was aimed at. In their own ways, the two men were focused on the same part of the shard, one of its outermost corners, where the widest part of the Sugarloaf terminated and connected to its base, along a sharp but irregular edge. There, embedded in the ice, was a scrap of structural framework about the size of a car. It served as the anchor for a cluster of small conical rocket nozzles, one of those thruster systems that had proven so miserably underpowered for the current job. Aiming another camera at it, Dinah saw a steady jet of blue-white fire emerging from two of the nozzles. They were burning continuously, full blast. They weren't designed to do that. But Ymir's attitude control system had calculated that thrust, and a lot of it needed to be applied in those two directions if its programmed objective, getting the ship's nose pointed forward and her nozzle aft, were to be achieved. Dinah got it. Her thinking was confirmed by the chatter she could now hear, in a mix of English, German, and Russian, between Marcus and Vyacheslav. But she could see in her mind's eye what Ymir must look like right now to Marcus, viewing it through the front window of New Caird. A huge, drifting arrowhead of black ice, generally dark, but decorated at the nose and corners by twinkling white lights and streaks of hot gas. The exhaust from the thrusters, running an automatic program controlled from within. Sometimes they flashed on and off. Occasionally, though, when a lot of thrust was called for in one place, they ran for a long time. Those long, steady burns would stand out clearly against the dark of space. Marcus didn't need to calculate Ymir's rotation in his head. He didn't need to know her spin rates about her three axes or the torque needed to counteract them. He didn't even need to pull up the user interface on his tablet. All he had to do was fly around the shard and look for places where thrusters were staying on continuously. Those were the ones that were overloaded and underpowered. Those were, therefore, the ones where New Caird's big engine could be used most effectively. But how? Her view of the thruster system was interrupted by a blurry gray form. Vyacheslav moving in front of the camera. He then came back into focus, groping for a carabiner along his waist and snapping it onto a structural member that protruded from the ice. Dinah could hear him breathing. Bracing himself with his left hand, he reached into the network of struts with his right. After a bit of groping, he seemed to find something, then worked for a minute, his arm reciprocating slightly. The thruster jets faltered and winked out.
"Done,"
Vyacheslav said.
"Apologies. Valve was sticking."
"Get clear, Tovarich,"
Marcus said.
"Getting,"
Slava returned. He unhooked the carabiner and bent away from the framework, trusting himself to the grabs zip-tied to his feet, and began to move away with the painfully slow gait of a man walking in hot caramel.
"Just do it,"
he said, then added a phrase in German that Dinah was pretty sure meant, "If it doesn't work, we're all dead anyway." New Caird drifted out of frame. Dinah spent a few moments reacquiring her view. The smaller ship was closing on Ymir, headed directly for the thruster system that Slava had just shut down, and coming in on an angle between the two nozzles that had been burning. The logic was clear. The method was insane. New Caird was going to do the job that the tiny thrusters couldn't. Marcus had to get her big nozzle aimed in about the right direction, namely, about halfway between the two that had been doing all the work. Fine. But he was also going to have to make a mechanical connection between New Caird and the shard so that the thrust of the big engine could be transmitted into the mass of ice. And it looked like he was going to achieve this by ramming the little ship into the big one. It was a slow ramming, like a tugboat shoving its nose against the side of an oil tanker to nudge it into a berth. But it was ramming nonetheless, not a thing for which spacecraft were generally designed. She relaxed her painfully tight grip on the edge of the table just a bit when, moments before the collision, Marcus fired the retrothrusters, slowing New Caird at the moment of impact. But still she felt, and heard, the crunch resounding through the walls of the ice palace. She'd heard it before over the last couple of hours and wondered what it was. Apparently, Marcus had done this several times already.
He had aimed for the place where the structural framework emerged from the ice, forming a sort of angle into which New Caird's nose could trap itself, as long as the thrust stayed on. Right now, that force was being delivered by her aft thrusters. But Dinah, watching Marcus's face through the front window, saw him working at the touchscreen that served as New Caird's control panel and had a pretty good idea of what was coming next. She pulled up the interface for Ymir's attitude control system and saw craziness. Thrusters firing all over the shard, lit up by angry Akhan's warming of too little propellant, not enough time, overheated nozzles. The thing that Marcus had just rammed was flashing red, indicating that it wasn't even connected to the system anymore. Graphs at the bottom of the screen, and a three-dimensional rendering of the shard in space, showed just how far off they were from where they wanted to be. She heard a little symphony of grinding, groaning, and popping, and felt the ship rotating around her. The video feed showing New Caird was awash in white light as her main propulsion came on full blast. A quick glance at the attitude control plots showed good things happening.
"It is good," Shiro said, "but we are going to over-rotate now."
"Not if I got the timing right," Marcus said. "We should rotate through the correct attitude just at the time of the apogee burn. Afterward, yes. We'll over-rotate, but we'll have plenty of time to fix it."
Then his transmission was cut off by an exclamation and a thud. He cursed in German, and then the audio went dead. Dinah looked at the video feed to see New Caird canted over at the wrong angle. The flame from the engine flickered out. The framework against which New Caird had been pushing had given way under the thrust of the big engine and crumpled, causing her to slew around. She now lay almost sideways against the ice, the crushed remains of the thruster system sandwiched between her hull and the stern of Ymir.
"Some kind of gas escaping,"
Jiro observed quietly, "or smoke." He was right. The eye didn't pick it up right away because smoke behaved differently in space than in an atmosphere, under gravity. But something was burning, or at least smoldering, along the side of New Caird's hull, no more than an arm's length from where Marcus sat. Vyacheslav said,
"The hot nozzle of the thruster is melting through the hull."
Marcus came back on the air.
"Jiro and Dinah, you must be ready to fire the main propulsion at apogee."
The word was cut off by a constriction in his throat and he coughed several times. When he resumed speaking, his voice had a strangled timbre.
"About 2 minutes from now. Focus on that. Initiate the startup procedures. Vyacheslav can help me with this little problem."
He was coughing convulsively.
"Switching off," he said.
Dinah, against orders, made a last glance at the video feed showing the nose of New Caird. Through its front window, she could no longer see Marcus. She could see only smoke and the flickering, lambent light of a fire within it. The realization of what was happening struck her like a 2x4 across the forehead. She grabbed the edge of the table and closed her eyes for a few moments, felt them fill with hot water, felt the snot flooding into her nose. "Dinah," Jiro said, "the Augur startup checklist begins now." She opened her eyes and saw glowing blurs where user interface widgets ought to have been.
"If it is to mean anything," Jiro said, "please."
Then he reached up to enclose his headset's little microphone with one hand, muffling the sound, and added,
"He can probably hear us."
She reached out and typed a command.
"Augur One," she said, "go."
And she slapped the enter key. And so on down the list. It got easier as she went. Jiro did his part of it, delicately, quietly, efficiently. And when the nuke came on to full power, right on schedule, she made sure to mention it, loudly, in case Marcus could hear them. Only then did she look at the video feed. She was expecting to see Marcus's final resting place, a tomb of acrid smoke. But there was nothing there except a crumpled framework,
and Vyacheslav, standing with one hand braced against it, gazing away aft. In the background, a spreading plume of steam the size of Manhattan as Jiro's engine fired. "Slava," she said, "where is..."
"She fell off,"
Vyacheslav answered.
"When the engine came on, and we began to accelerate. Nukerd did not come along for the ride."
"Is she..."
"She was entrained in the plume of steam and thrown back. I can hardly even see her now."
"Oh."
"Dinah?"
"Yes, Slava."
"Marcus was already dead."
It would read almost a slapstick comedy if it were not so tragic, the consequences so dire, Julia said. She was mesmerized by a video loop, the final transmission from Nukerd before radio contact had been lost. The people hovering around her in the white arclet, as Julia's unofficial base of operations had come to be known, all nodded or made agreeable-sounding murmurs. They were all reading Tav's blog post about the Ymir catastrophe, which had been posted only seconds ago. The one exception was Tekla, who had become distracted by a detail. Attached to the wall of the arclet, with strips of blue masking tape, was a sheet of paper on which had been printed the seal of the President of the United States. Only two printers remained in existence, and both of them were on Izzy. So by process of elimination, this must have been printed on old Earth, prior to the hard rain, by a device that had been running a little low on cyan ink. It had seen hard service. It was torn in two places and repaired with clear tape. It had been creased and crumpled, then smoothed out. Its edges were fuzzy where previous applications of tape had been peeled away. And in the white space below and to the right of the presidential seal, there was a brown smudge, oval, the size of the ball of a person's thumb. As a matter of fact, Tekla was certain that it was actually a thumbprint, and the more she looked at it, the more certain she became that the brown substance was blood. She looked Julia in the eye and became aware that the former president was awaiting some form of reaction from her. Unlike most people, Tekla felt no pressure, no obligation to fulfill any such expectations. Julia, a bit unnerved by that, broke eye contact and continued. "I don't quite understand the story they are telling us, anyway."
"It is pretty convoluted,"
said one of her aides, a young male Arky with an American accent. He was one of the MIV engineers. His tone suggested that he was amused by the sheer cheekiness of the powers that be in trying to get people to believe such a yarn, and that he was much too clever to be taken in.
"It kind of hinges on the idea that the hull was made of what amounts to plastic. If it gets too hot, it..."
"It's like plastic on a stove burner, I understand that," Julia said. "It melts and it stinks."
"Nukerd shifted in a way that caused the hull to come into contact with a nozzle that was extremely hot."
"But according to the story they are putting out, Vyacheslav had shut that nozzle off beforehand."
"They stay hot for a long time. Anyway, the nozzle melted right through the hull. First, it would have made a lot of toxic smoke. That would have been enough to kill him. Then, when the melting proceeded to the point where the hull was perforated, all the air would have escaped through the hole."
"Well, that is horrible, if it is true," Julia said, and then swiveled her eyes toward Tekla, looking for some sign in the visitor's face that it might not be true. Tekla stared back at her in a manner that betrayed nothing. "What sort of pass have we come to, one wonders, when such crazy improvisations are called for, ramming one ship with another?" More murmurs of agreement. Julia was on a roll, and as far as I can make out, it didn't even solve the problem.
"Problem is solved," Tekla said.
She was fluent in English and was perfectly capable of saying, "the problem is solved," but sometimes dropped the article for effect. Anglophones found this mysterious and impressive. It was also an implicit statement of Russian pride. The language of the Cloud Ark, by default, was English. That was never going to change. But the dialect was going to evolve over time, and Russians could bend it in their direction by finding ways to inject their grammar and vocabulary into everyday speech.
Vern is complete, she went on.
But the ship is still tumbling out of control,
said the American boy who so fancied his own intelligence.
Slow tumble, Tekla said. Not problem. Plenty of time to fix now that perigee is raised.
Fix it how? Marcus demolished 3 of the external thruster packages by ramming them. Who does that? Anyway, there are only 2 of them left. It's a basic reality of physics that you can't control a 3-axis tumble using only 2 thrusters.
Thank you for explaining basic reality, Tekla said. Tumble can be eliminated by making scarfed nozzle.
This silenced them for a few moments. One of Julia's followers, Jian Yu, a Chinese Arky very passionate about going to Mars, looked like he understood it. Tekla nodded in his direction.
This man will explain later. My time here is limited.
Yes, Tekla, and we do appreciate that you've been able to make time for us at all, Julia said. Tekla wanted to slap her so much that her hand actually twitched. The sentence Julia had just spoken, had it been delivered in a different tone, might have actually meant what it said. Instead of which, it meant, I am being callously ignored, and it's about time someone important came out to talk to me. Tekla had an almost physical sense of how that mentality was radiating outward from Julia to infect the other Arkies. Like almost everyone else in the Cloud Ark, Tekla was wearing a coverall with many pockets, compartments, external holsters, and the like. One of them contained a knife with a 4-inch, double-edged blade. Its tip could find JBF's heart easily. Tekla faded from the conversation briefly as she considered how to manage this. Julia probably wouldn't be expecting a frank assassination attempt, though you never really knew with people who had such minds.
Tekla said, Would you like to report any difficulties with the San? Repeated outages have been observed.
Julia pressed her lips together in a satisfied way and looked towards Spencer Grindstaff.
First I've heard of it, Spencer said.
The statement was met with perfect deadpan silence. Tekla just waited. Soon the temptation to boast would get the better of them. Her training in tradecraft, in how to be a spy, had not been all that extensive. A few basic courses, some assigned reading. The reason was simple. She was too conspicuous to be useful as a spy, too similar to the Hollywood profile. Real spies went unnoticed. So they had kicked her out of the program and put her to work in roles, such as being an Olympic athlete, where her conspicuousness was an asset. But she had picked up a few general precepts, and she knew that this one thing, the urge to boast of one's accomplishments, had betrayed more secrets and destroyed more careers than anything else. She looked at Grindstaff. Unlike most people who soon broke eye contact, he looked right back at her, grinning.
Unusual, Tekla said, for one of your background.
Sources and methods, he said.
Then I will confine my remarks to what I came here for,
Tekla said. This produced an immediate exchange of glances between Julia and Spencer. Tekla ignored it.
For security reasons, it is imperative that we have accurate census of which person is in which arclet. Some people like to move around, to trade places. We understand. Fine. But safety and security problems are created when, for example, Arklet is struck by bolide. Air is leaking. We do not know how many people are in it, their medical requirements, etc. Small person needs less air than big person.
Julia was nodding. I take your point very clearly, Tekla. Speaking for the Archie community, I can confirm that a more informal mindset prevails out here on the outskirts. The perception of neglect by the powers that be on Izzy leads to a bit of a chip-on-the-shoulder attitude. Reshuffling of people between Arklets seems like a harmless form of rebellion, but it's easy to overlook the safety issue that you are pointing out, which is a mistake. I will say that the confusion as to the real threat level we are under, as long as we
confine ourselves to dirty space,
Ravi Kumar threw in. Yes, thank you, Ravi. It just seems that one day we hear one thing, the next day we hear another.
Statistics, Tekla said.
Yes, that is what we are told again and again, but I can see no more, Tekla offered, and flicked her eyes at one of the small cameras mounted to the hull of the Arklet. Julia held her gaze this time, and after a few moments threw a glance Spencer's way. Tekla, a minute ago we were dancing around the topic of the Situational Awareness Network, and Spencer was being a bit light-hearted, his sense of humor at work. But I feel comfortable telling you that, thanks to Spencer, we do have a way to disconnect from the SAN when we want to just have a normal conversation without wondering who might be listening in. And we have done so now. Anything you say here and now will not leave this Arklet. Tekla favored the circle of hangers-on and admirers with a long, slow, panoramic look, then actually rolled her eyes.
Everyone out, Julia commanded.
You too, Spencer. Just Tekla and me.
Your tradecraft is of low quality,
Tekla said, when all the others had dispersed through the hamster tubes to the other Arklets in Julia's heptad.
I know, Julia said. It is so difficult rebuilding an intelligence community from scratch.
One must make do with the materials at hand. Their youth, their inexperience, and the openness they have come to expect from living their whole lives on the Internet, all are inimical to doing things as they ought to be done. That is why we need more experienced hands, people who have learned the right instincts.
It is not just that, Tekla said. That is obvious.
Oh? Julia narrowed her eyes. What have I missed that is not so obvious?
You should not trust Zeke Peterson with further information, Tekla said, unless you wish to plant false intelligence, in which case he will be an effective channel.
Ivy and Zeke and Tekla had discussed it beforehand, and Zeke had cheerfully volunteered to be given up by Tekla as a supposed turncoat. It made little difference to him personally, and it would go a long way to cementing the idea, in Julia's mind, of Tekla as a master double agent. By Cold War standards, it was an obvious and amateurish gambit. But this was not the Cold War. This was a small town of 1,500 people with a former mayor who was trying to stir up trouble. Julia narrowed her eyes and nodded slowly. She was fascinated.
I had wondered about him, she said. He seems like he was just playing along, just being polite. Not a problem with Tekla, Tekla said.
Julia liked that. She had drifted closer and now reached out to touch Tekla's forearm briefly.
I like that about you, Tekla. What I see is what I get. Yes.
Then, after a somewhat uneasy silence, Tekla added,
You play long game. Patient.
To a degree, Julia said. And suddenly her face and attitude had changed, as if her face had been recast in painted steel.
We cannot afford to be patient for very long. Marcus's death has changed everything. Until that tragic event, the members of the Archie community could look forward to the return of the great leader.
Ivy was a mere caretaker. Her shortcomings could be overlooked.
Now, awareness is spreading through the swarm that Marcus is not coming back. Ivy is back in power.
Sal will quote from obscure clauses in the Constitution to legitimize her status. But true legitimacy comes from the support of the governed. She'll be moving now to solidify her hold on the reins. It's at such a time that small, symbolic gestures can have the greatest effect. And that, Tekla, is why the next few days are such a critical time for us. Perhaps Ymir will pull through, perhaps not. We can't afford to wait. Preparations are afoot. 3 days from now, Arklets will begin to break free of the Cloud Ark and begin their epic trek to high orbit. The powers that be might fear to implement the pure swarm strategy for the loss of control it will mean for them, but the Arky community, tired of huddling behind an ineffective shield, slowly being decimated by the hard rain, knows no such limitations.
Survival of the breakaway group will demonstrate the falsity of the G-Pop's predictions of danger,
Tekla said, nodding.
The power of the center will be broken.
For the first time, the Cloud Ark Constitution will truly come into effect, Julia said. Notwithstanding the sophistry of the apologist Saul Guodian, that constitution, Tekla, as I'm sure you know, calls for the formation of a security force. Not the Praetorian Guard that Marcus cobbled together, but something real. I can think of no one better qualified than you to command it.
Hook, line, and sinker,
said Spencer Grindstaff, as he and Julia watched Tekla's flivver depart with a staccato series of thruster burns.
Oh, she definitely bought it, Julia admitted. But I don't like the note of triumphalism in your voice, Spencer. What we've really learned is that Ivy is a formidable opponent. Somehow she has managed to get people like Tekla on her side, and they have come up with a fairly elaborate strategy for penetrating our organization.
Grindstaff shrugged.
As these things go, it's not that elaborate. Kind of obvious, really.
Easy to say, Julia said. Given that you have a bug hidden in the banana, and we knew everything they were going to do. But lacking that information, Spencer, do you really think we'd have seen through it?
I thought Tekla did a marvelous job.
You need to look out for her. She really hates you. And she's carrying at least one weapon.
Thanks to Pete Starling, Julia said. So am I.
She reached into her bag and drew out a small revolver, just far enough that Spencer could see the butt of its grip, then slid it back in.
At the risk of insulting your intelligence, Spencer said, I would like to remind you of the consequences of firing that thing inside of a space vehicle.
No offense taken. I've actually seen those consequences. And you know what? The air doesn't leak out that fast. Anyway, I'm told that the rounds in this weapon are designed to mushroom on impact, so they are less likely to exit the body.
That's great, Spencer said, provided you actually hit a body.
If it comes down to me and Tekla, Julia said, I'm not going to miss.
All Dinah wanted to do was sleep. Since New Caird had departed from Izzy, she had never gotten more than 4 consecutive hours, and the numbers for the last day or so were even more dismal. In a weird way, she wanted to sleep so that she would be able to grieve properly. She knew Marcus was dead, but it hadn't really sunk in. Nor would it, as long as she was running from one crisis to the next. The burn had worked. Ymir's perigee altitude had been raised to the point where it would never again be troubled by the atmosphere. But the ship was still tumbling, albeit slowly. And Vyacheslav was still trudging around on its outer surface with his feet zip-tied to grabs. At the start of this extravehicular activity, Slava had exited through the airlock on the side of New Caird, a ship that was no longer with them. His supplies were running low. He had to get inside the command module before he ran out of air. This could be achieved using an airlock built in for that purpose. It was located adjacent to the docking port in the nose of the ice-buried command module. Passing through it, he would enter the uppermost level of the module, where he could breathe the same air as everyone else. But he had taken the precaution of checking himself out with an inspector,
and found powerful radiation coming from several locations on his suit. Basically, wherever he had come into contact with the surface of the shard. "I was worried about this," Jiro said, "but there was nothing to be done." "Worried about what?" Dinah asked. "I thought the surface was reasonably clean."
"It was," Jiro said. "Until we did the perigee burn. The nozzle was pointed forward. Some of the steam was blown back over us by the wind. By the atmosphere we were passing through. It condensed and stuck to the surface of the shard. So now there are little pieces of fallout all over the outside of Ymir. And some of them have gotten stuck to Slava's spacesuit."
"He's got to get out of that thing."
Jiro shrugged. "The suit will block most of the beta. I mean, he's got to get out of it before he runs out of oxygen."
"That is true."
"Which means he has to come in here."
"Also true."
"He's going to bring that radiation inside with him.
It will take weeks to kill us. By that time, we will have accomplished our mission. Or not."
In the end, though, they came up with a workaround that did not involve dying, which was that they taped some plastic over the companionway that joined the command module's top level to the one below it. Before doing so, they moved a generous supply of food and water to that level, along with toiletries, a sleep sack, and other items Vyacheslav would be needing. Slava passed through the airlock with some minutes to spare, doffed his suit, and closed it up in the chamber of the airlock, which would block most of the beta radiation coming off it. He then stripped off his clothes and went through several repetitions of decontaminating himself with pre-moistened towelettes, throwing all of it into the airlock chamber before slamming its hatch shut. Then he threw up. The upper level of the command module, along with Slava himself, now had to be treated as contaminated. But they didn't need it anymore. Jiro and Dinah would be confined to the lower levels, separated from Vyacheslav and the possible contamination by a sheet of plastic, until they reached Izzy or died. A common air supply circulated through all the levels in ducts, but it had a filter system which they hoped would catch any floating motes of fallout. Having seen to all of those matters, they turned out the lights and slept. Dinah slept through her alarm, in fact, and finally woke up to realize she'd been out for 12 hours. Her next thought was to wonder where Marcus was. Then she remembered, with a kind of astonishment, that he was dead. It came as a stinging slap, followed by grief. But on the heels of the grief came a feeling of deep fear that she had rarely experienced in all the time since Zero. It was not the sharp, bracing fear one felt on an adventure, such as the ride through perigee, nor the kind of intellectual, abstract fear that had been with them ever since Dube had predicted the hard rain. This was a kind of morbid panic that was second cousin to depression. It was how a child might feel upon learning that she had been orphaned. Not a child, rather, but an adolescent, the oldest sibling, on whom responsibility for the family now fell. Marcus was gone. He wasn't going to shoulder any more burdens for them. Others would have to take up those burdens, and some of those, the ones perhaps most eager to step into Marcus's place, would certainly make the wrong decisions. And so, as sad as Dinah felt about the fact that she would never see Marcus again or feel his embrace, the thing that really made her want to contract into a fetal position was this knowledge that it was on her now. On her and Ivy and Dube and the others who could be trusted. She went up into the common room and found Jiro, as usual, lost in contemplation of arcane plots on his computer screen, reflected in miniature on the lenses of his bifocals. During the year he had been in space, his prescription had changed, and so he had been the first consumer of the optical lens-grinding machine that had been sent up and installed in Izzy. Without it, much of the Cloud Ark's population would gradually have been rendered non-productive as their eyeglasses were broken or wore out. It was a military machine capable of making glasses in one style and one style only. At some point, a few years down the road, Everyone who needed glasses would be wearing this style. It was interesting to contemplate how many decades or centuries would have to go by before the population had grown and the economy developed to the point where it could support an eyewear industry with different styles. He looked up at her through the milky reflections. "I let you sleep," he said. "Your robots seem to be working fine. There is nothing to do until I finish these calculations." "And then what?"
"We have to eliminate the last of the tumbling," Juro said, "before we make the final breaking burns."
For Dinah, that was all clear. Ymir was in a safe orbit now and would not fall into the atmosphere any time soon. But she was still going much too fast and way too high to rendezvous with Izzy. They needed to finish the execution of the same plan they'd had all along, which was to make one or two more breaking burns as Ymir passed through her perigee, slowing her down to the point where a rendezvous with Izzy was feasible. This required getting the nozzle pointed forward again, and keeping it that way.
"How much damage was done to the..."
"They were destroyed," Juro said. "We have two remaining."
They were both referring to the thruster packages, embedded in the ice, that would normally have been used to manage the shard's attitude.
"It is fine.
It was necessary," Juro added, almost as if worried that Dinah would think poorly of him for criticizing the decisions made by a dead commander.
"Can more be sent out from..."
Juro nodded.
"It is possible to assemble a MIV that could rendezvous with us and assist with the problem, just in case my idea does not succeed. But since our radio link was lost with New Caird, we cannot coordinate this."
"And what is your idea?"
"We can use your robots to alter the shape of the nozzle exit," Juro said.
He held up one hand like a blade, pointed toward the ceiling, and then flexed his knuckles slightly, indicating a shallow bend.
"Make it asymmetrical."
"Like a scarfed nozzle?"
"Exactly. When we fire the main propulsion, it will give us an off-axis thrust. If the scarf is oriented correctly, it will have tremendous control authority."
"Maybe too much," Dinah said. "We'll end up overcorrecting."
"One thing at a time," Juro said. "We scarf the nozzle, we do a little correction, we scarf it the other way, we kill the rotation. It might take several repetitions. It can be done. I have been modeling it."
Dinah pulled herself into position before her triptych of flat panels and began opening windows, checking on the activities of her menagerie of robots, some sunning themselves on the outside to soak up power, others sipping juice from the reactors, some mining propellant for the next burn, others mending the nozzle. The latter group, mostly gnats, would be responsible for the nozzle sculpting program. Until now, having an asymmetrical nozzle, delivering thrust at an off angle, had been a problem to be avoided, not a feature to be encouraged. Juro had emailed her some diagrams of what the nozzle bell would need to look like. The alterations were surprisingly minor. In an engine that produced that much power, a little bit of off-axis thrust went a long way.
"When's our next perigee?" she asked.
"We just went through one, so about 8 hours from now."
The paramount duty of the Cloud Ark's commander, so important that Marcus had broken character and described it to Ivy as sacred, was to stay on top of the bolide scan, which was a feed of information synthesized out of all of Izzy's long-range radars and optical telescopes. A disproportionate number of GPOP members devoted their lives to managing this, or to maintaining the equipment used to produce it. Because the stream of data was continuous, it needed to be broken down for the consumption of someone like Marcus or Ivy, into reports that showed up on their screens at regular intervals. A triurnal bolide scan was issued at the top of each shift, .0, .8, and .16. Ivy read one of them when she woke up, another in the middle of her afternoon, and the third just before going to sleep. Each of these summarized what was known about bolides that might come near them during the next 8 hours, and made recommendations as to what maneuvers the Cloud Ark should execute in order to avoid them. Typically, they made small burns several times a day for this purpose. The policy was default go, which meant that the maneuver would be promulgated to the Cloud Ark via perambulator and carried out automatically unless the commander vetoed it. The only reason this was ever likely to happen was in cases where two dangerous rocks were headed their way at about the same time and they needed to make a decision. Such events had occurred twice during the hard rain so far, but they had been simulated and wargamed hundreds of times before that. The name of the game was to avoid getting cornered. To be detected 8 hours in advance, a bolide had to be pretty big. Smaller ones came along all the time and weren't picked up on the radars until minutes or even seconds before collision. Accordingly, smaller reports were issued at the top of every hour, listing all noteworthy rocks that had been detected during the last 60 minutes. This covered most of them, so the commander, or whoever covered for her while she was sleeping, could discharge most of her responsibilities in re the bolide scan by dropping everything else she was doing at the top of each hour and reading it. From time to time, however, they would become aware of a hot rock, or streaker, that had surprised them by coming in from a weird angle, or at unusually high speed. And then the commander would be notified immediately so that an alert could be issued and evasive action could be seen to. The streaker alerts combined elements of the small-town Midwestern tornado siren with the red alert from Star Trek. All sleeping people were awakened, all non-essential personnel were evacuated from the larger tori, which were considered most vulnerable, and hatches were closed between different sections, in case of a breach. Similar precautions were taken by the Arkies. Arklets were, of course, more vulnerable to bolide strikes, but they were also more maneuverable. As the hot rock drew closer and its orbital parameters were determined more precisely, the data would be fed to perambulator. Any arklets in danger of being hit would be identified, and a collective solution would be calculated that would enable them to move into safer trajectories without banging into anyone else. These events happened, on average, between 1 and 2 times a day, but as always, the devil was in the statistical details. They had once gone 3 days without a single streaker. On another occasion, they'd had 5 of them within a 12-hour period. The first of these events had caused an upwelling of chatter on Spacebook to the effect that the powers that be were overstating the threat in order to cow the Arkies into submission. And the second had generated a hard-hitting blog post from Tav Prowse calling the G-pop on the carpet for systematic incompetence. It was in the wake of such an alert, while cleaning up her desktop of post-action chatter, that Ivy's attention was drawn to a post that had just come up on Tav's blog. An interview with Ulrika Eck.
"Ulrika has a lot to learn about bloggers,"
was Ivy's verdict, after she'd finished reading it. She shook her head.
"You'd think she, of all people, would know. She's been through PR training."
These remarks were delivered to a banana that had been slowly repopulating itself during the last few minutes, with people who had been called away on other duties during the streaker alert. Tekla was the last to arrive, bringing Tom Van Meter and other members of Marcus's security detail in her wake. Louisa and Sal were already present in the room. Dube had just texted his regrets, explaining that he needed to crunch some numbers about what had just happened. "She probably dropped her guard," Louisa suggested, thinking she was just chatting informally.
"You've read it, then?"
"I scanned it."
"Referring to what?"
Tekla asked. "Ulrika made a few off-the-cuff remarks about swarm theory and which strategies we might wish to pursue in the future, and Tav is blowing them up into a cause célèbre," Ivy said.
"What, if anything, would you like to do about it?"
Sal asked.
"Nothing," Ivy said. "Look, the longer this thing with Ymir continues, the more anxiety people have about the big ride. Every time a hot rock comes in, it juices up that anxiety for a little while. Well, either it'll work or it won't. If it doesn't work, then we have very little choice anyway. We have to dump and run."
Sal nodded.
But if it does work, it'll change everything about the way people think.
Ivy nodded. Yeah, and I'm growing certain that it will. Even if the scarfed nozzle gambit fails, we still have that MIV we can send out as a backup plan. I think that in a week, we'll have a successful rendezvous with Ymir and we'll be prepping for the big ride. Ivy made a gesture, indicating that the new arrivals should find places for themselves around the table. Which brings me to the topic of this meeting, she continued. We know what JBF's plan is. She's recruiting some number of Arkies willing to strike out on their own. The general scheme seems to be that they'll get a few Arklets stocked with provisions for a few weeks' journey. Then, on a signal, they'll break away from Izzy and make burns that will take them to a higher orbit. An orbit that we can't reach without expending a lot of propellant. We don't know what their long-term plan is, or if they even have one, but I think Julia is basically playing the odds that these people will survive long enough to send back messages saying, come on in, the water's fine, and encourage other Arkies to follow suit. They all know that they can't really be pursued once they've departed the swarm. Membership in the Cloud Ark is, under the current state of affairs, voluntary.
I infer you mean to change that? Louisa asked dryly, casting her gaze over Tekla and the members of the squad.
They can't make a break for it without hoarding certain critical supplies, Ivy said. We can't allow people to just ransack our storage facilities for whatever they want, and we have clear evidence that this has been happening. There's traffic on Spacebook about where to look if you want to score a box of fresh batteries or scrubber cartridges. So our basic approach to this is going to be simple. We've identified the worst offenders, where hoarding is concerned. I'm going to make an announcement in an hour explaining how the Cloud Ark Constitution works when it comes to theft of public supplies. And I'm going to offer a 24-hour amnesty during which anyone can turn in stuff they have been hoarding. As soon as that time is up, Tekla and her team are going to move on one Arklet that we know is being used as a storage dump for contraband, and they are going to restore order. And then Sal will step in as prosecutor and take whatever action he deems justified.
How can you put people in jail when they are already confined to tin cans? Louisa asked. How can you find them when there's no money?
We will have to evolve solutions as we go, Sal said.
Tekla stared him down, then drew her thumb across her throat.
Well, that seems definitive, Julia said.
She and Spencer Grindstaff were hovering in the middle of the white Arklet. Drifting near them was a laptop whose speakers had been playing the audio feed from the banana. They could hear the sounds of the meeting breaking up and people separating into smaller conversations as they moved out of the room. Spencer pulled it closer and whacked the volume button a few times to mute the sound.
As I said before, hook, line, and sinker.
Unless, Julius said, they are somehow aware of the fact that we have surveillance on the banana, and everything we just heard was a sort of radio play staged for our benefit. Spencer beamed.
Now that is paranoid. I thought I had it bad, but...
Just kidding, Julius said a little too quickly. This is actionable, Spencer. I believe we are justified in taking everything we just heard at face value, which means... I am comfortable giving good news to the Martians. Are they ready?
Yes, they've been waiting,
Spencer said, and thumbed out a text message to summon them. The Martians all had to come via the same hamster tube, so it took a few moments for the core members of the first human expedition to the Red Planet to filter in. Dr. Catherine Quine, whose professional role was obvious, Ravi Kumar, who would be the expedition's commander, Li Jianyu, who would act as a general science officer, and Paul Friel, an American MIV expert, the head engineer. They, as well as a score of other Arkies waiting in the wings, had sworn an oath that they'd not spend the rest of their lives sealed up in tin cans, but would walk on the surface of Mars or die in the attempt. In their wake came several other members of Julia's staff.
Julia opened the meeting with a few words of greeting and a solemn announcement to the effect that the Mars mission was a go. Once the ensuing round of zero-G high-fives and embraces had trailed off into an awkward silence, she singled out Paul Friel. "Paul, no doubt you've briefed these others on the very latest while you were so patiently cooling your heels. But might I know what has been going on with the MIV?"
"Of course, Madam President. As you know, they're trying to stabilize Ymir with..."
"A Rube Goldberg scheme in the form of an ice sculpture. Yes, I know about that." Paul chuckled, showing a lot of gum.
"Not surprisingly, the powers that be are a little nervous about that, and so word came down from on high that we ought to be preparing a backup plan, so we can go pull Ymir's fat from the fire if need be. Well, that couldn't be better from a Martian point of view. As you know, we have been planning this mission for years. After Zero, I kept it going as a side project all through the development of the MIV program, and we managed to grease it in as one of the use cases."
"Use cases?"
"One of the hypothetical uses to which the MIV kit might eventually be put,"
Spencer explained.
"Basically, it just gave us an excuse to include a few components, like throttleable landing engines and aeroshield material, that might not have made it in otherwise,"
Paul went on.
"So stabilizing Red Rover's design has been a piece of cake."
"Red Rover?"
"Yeah, that's what we're calling her."
"I would like to propose something a little more suggestive of a higher purpose," Julia said. "Spearhead or some such thing." This led to an uneasy silence, terminated by Camilla, who said, "I'll drop a list of options and submit it to you right away, Madam President."
"Thank you, Camilla."
"You understand, Paul, that this mission will have symbolic as well as scientific value, and we want to send the right message to the other Arkies so that they will feel inspired to follow in her wake."
"Of course. Consider it a working title only,"
Paul said.
"A code name."
"It's not even good as a code name,"
Spencer pointed out.
"Because anyone can..."
"Let's move on," Julia said. "You were talking, Paul, about the design."
"Done. It took like a man day. We just had to make a few tweaks to a pre-existing use case to reflect the materials and supplies we actually had on hand."
"Excellent."
"But a design is not a ship, of course," Paul continued, "and until a couple of days ago it would have been pretty darn hard to put the actual propulsion system together without bringing down the wrath of Ivy."
"That is not a phrase calculated to strike fear into the heart of anyone except those most worshipful of her authority," Julia remarked, speaking with the gravity that could only be summoned by one who had recently used nuclear weapons on live targets. Paul cackled.
"You know what I'm saying, though. Everything happens in a fishbowl here. So, you can imagine the grin on my face when we got the order to begin assembling the Ymir Rescue MIV."
"Are the specifications similar?"
"Similar enough. They can both use the same main engine. The thruster packages, the control systems, life support, all of that stuff is completely standardized. It doesn't change from one use case to another. It's just a matter of punching different parameters into the code. It's just a config file."
Seeing that Julia didn't necessarily know what a config file was, Spencer put in,
"They can essentially download the DNA, if you will, of Red Rover, or whatever they end up calling it, into the Ymir rescue vehicle with a few keystrokes."
Satisfied with that, Julia asked, "What of the Arklets, the Heptad and the Triad?"
"Well, they're already functional, independent space vehicles. Way more than enough space for 24 Martians and their vitamins. Obviously, we've been stocking up,"
Paul said, waving his hands around at the bags of food and other supplies crowding the white Arklet.
"Yes," Julia said, "but the critical part of the operation is going to be moving them from their default positions in the swarm, which will seem unremarkable as far as Perambulator is concerned, to the propulsion stack that you have been assembling. And that's going to make a hell of a stink, is it not?"
The smile on Paul Friel's face became a bit frozen.
"We could just go for it," he said.
"I have a workaround,"
said Spencer Grindstaff.
"I think we can make this happen.
A streaker alert is all we need. It'll go down tomorrow.
How do you know there's going to be a streaker alert?
Such an event is nothing, Spencer said, other than a particular configuration of bits.
Dinah had been dreaming of Mars. As an asteroid miner, she had never been that interested in the distant and inhospitable red planet. The politics of the pre-zero space exploration world had obliged her to show skepticism, even disdain, toward those who wanted to go there and build colonies and terraform the planet. Mars colonists were siphoning attention and resources away from the asteroid miners, who wanted to use easier-to-get-to resources to make much more human-friendly habitats. Space colonies, rotating to provide full gravity with plenty of water and fresh air. In any event, it had been a dead issue for 2 years. But that didn't prevent Mars from showing up in her dreams, and now infiltrating her daydreams. Almost 3 years now had gone by since she had walked on the surface of a planet, looked up into a sky, seen a horizon. Intellectually, she knew that death would take her, sooner or later, before she did any of those things again. She and everyone else in the Cloud Ark would live out their lives in environments resembling bomb shelters, hospital basements, and research labs. The best they could hope for was to look out a small window at the starry sky. The view of the blue, green, and white Earth had once provided fascination and solace. The orange ball of fire they now circled was such a disagreeable sight that most people actively avoided looking at it. No one was ever going back there. For those who still aspired to go for a walk before dying of old age, Mars was the only hope, be it ever so impractical. People had been talking about it on Spacebook and on some of the blogs that had been cropping up on the New Ark's miniature internet. Before the loss of New Caird had severed Ymir's data link to the Cloud Ark, some of it had trickled through to her tablet, and Dinah read it in idle moments. At least she had some idle moments now. Since the decision to try the scarfed nozzle approach, they had executed 2 burns, about 24 hours apart, each with a slightly different configuration of the ice nozzle, a canted lip constructed by the gnat swarm, projecting almost imperceptibly above the aft surface of the shard and bending the torrent of steam slightly. The first of those burns had gotten them spinning the way they wanted to go, though spinning might be too strong a word for a rotation that took the better part of a day. During that day, the gnats had decamped to the other side of the nozzle's rim and built a lip there. The second burn, then, had stopped the rotation that the first one had started and brought them close enough to their desired attitude that the surviving thrusters could handle the details. Another perigee was coming up soon. This time the nozzle would be aimed the way they wanted it. Forward, once again turning the nuclear engine into a powerful retro-rocket. The robots on the inside of the shard had been at work scooping it out, sculpting the walnut shell architecture that, according to the structural engineering simulations, would enable the whole thing to hold together during the last round of maneuvers. The hoppers were full of ice, with more on the way, and they'd finally learned how to make the system work consistently. Part of that lesson was not to try to accomplish too much with any one burn. It was better to take it easy, to set a reasonable Delta V target, get it done and lock it down, then take stock of the situation and plan the next burn at leisure. Consequently, their rendezvous with Izzy looked to be happening much later than they'd first expected, and almost every day brought a further postponement. But at the same time, it came to seem more and more of a sure thing, less of a wild chance, and this began to affect Dinah's thinking. Her robots were doing their work almost entirely on autopilot, leaving her somewhat bored. Vyacheslav, sealed up on the other side of a wall of plastic, could be talked to, but preferred keeping to himself. Jiro, on the other hand, had been working almost around the clock and been showing signs of strain. Dinah would find excuses to float behind him and look over his shoulder at his screen. Was he playing solitaire?
running orbital mechanics simulations, writing his memoirs. He seemed mostly to be looking at video feeds of machinery. By process of elimination, this had to be near the core of the reactor. In the floor of the bottommost level, three stories below them, was a manhole giving way to a shaft sunk into the ice. At the far end of that shaft was another hatch providing access to what, on an ocean-going ship of old Earth, would have been called the boiler room. A small pressurized compartment housed control panels and access ports connected to the reactor, which was only a few meters away on the other side of a heavy wall. The wall was a radiation shield, at least in theory. But sending up a huge piece of lead hadn't been an option for the hastily assembled Ymir expedition, and so the boiler room got washed with neutrons and gamma rays whenever the reactor was used. The radiation detectors that Sean and company had left behind, the last time they'd closed that hatch, didn't leave much to the imagination. The place was a hellhole now. Fortunately, all the systems connected there had been designed to be operated remotely.